Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point, a grim, record-breaking week. COVID-19 cases across the country surpassed 3 million. Against that backdrop, President Trump said it's time to reopen the nation's schools. Here's White House Press Secretary Kelsey McEnany.
The president has confidence in the conclusions of our medical experts, but it's up to him to determine what to do with that information and to take what we hear from Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, and others, and take what he values in their opinion and come to the ultimate consensus that's best for this country.
The Supreme Court handed down its final decisions of the summer. One of them could finally lead to the release of President Trump's tax returns, though probably not before the November election. Still, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi applauded the decision.
The Supreme Court, including the president's appointees, have declared that he is not above the law.
And in a huge historic victory for Indian country, the High Court ruled that much of eastern Oklahoma is a Native American reservation. Here's Sarah Hill, the Attorney General for the Cherokee Nation.
There's an emotional reaction to seeing the Supreme Court say what, you know, tribes and tribal advocates have been saying for a long time, which is that these promises that were made in these treaties had meaning.
We have a lot to talk about from this week and a group of great guests to help us. Betsy Woodruff Swan joins us from Washington, D.C., where she's national correspondent for Politico. Betsy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, happy Friday. Good to have you.
Hello, Anthony. Hello, Betsy.
And from Miami, Florida, Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter for WLRN, Miami's NPR station. Veronica's with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. Hello to all.
Hello to you. So lots to talk about this week, including that terrible milestone. America surpassed 3 million confirmed cases of coronavirus, with all but a handful of states struggling to control the infection rates. More than 130,000 people have died. Sadly, that number will only increase. Betsy, we've seen other countries contain this virus, but one of the takeaways this week is that America's still in its early stages, still in the sort of early innings of this fight against COVID-19. What's your takeaway?
That's right. It's something that's I think the most important takeaway from this is how deeply concerning and distressing this news is for people all around the country who are vulnerable to this illness, especially those with pre-existing conditions or other conditions that make them uniquely at risk. One piece of this story that I think is important to highlight is the fact of sort of the dissonance within Trump's political circles regarding basic facts about this pandemic. That footage that you played from Kayleigh McEnany included a phrase that I think bears highlighting. She said it was the president's job to decide what the quote unquote ultimate consensus was. But what they're talking about, what McEnany and the president are talking about when they discuss the situation with this pandemic in the United States, it's the opposite of a consensus. There's a consensus among public health professionals that the situation is dire and that Americans are in danger, but that consensus actually has not reached into the Oval Office. It has not reached the president. His approach to this pandemic is in defiance of the public health consensus. And that's something that deeply worries public health officials who see little evidence that that this awful episode is nearing its end anytime soon.
Yeah, and it seems to worry more and more American citizens. I'm looking at the results of a new ABC News Ipsos poll. Two-thirds of Americans now disapprove of President Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Those are some of his worst numbers to date. Jack, in many ways, this was the result of what lots of health experts had predicted. I mean, if you try to reopen while cases are still rising, it will only make things worse. And that seems to be what's happening in so many states, particularly in the South and the West. What are you taking away from this moment?
Well, David Brooks framed up my feelings pretty well in a stinging July 4th column entitled "The National Humiliation We Need." He says, "We had one collective project this year, and that was to crush COVID-19, and we failed. He said, we're confronted with a succession of wicked problems, and it turns out we're not even capable of putting on a frigging mask. Of course, he indicts, and rightly, the lethal incompetence in the Oval Office. But he also says, wait a minute, what about those people in bars, the young people who, you know, they had a moment of freedom, they went out, and now they're coming down with it. What about and he makes the point, he says, what about the doctors who came out and said, you know, it's all right for people to protest on the street. Nothing will happen. The American individualism or atomism or our unwillingness to care about other people seems to be the key, one of the key determinants of this thing. And when you look at the European line coming down and ours plateauing and then going up, that is a national disgrace. Trump is involved in it, but we all are. You know, during the war, the king made a tour of the East End looking at bombed out buildings, and someone yelled out, "You're a good king." He yelled back, "And you're a good people." It turns out we have a bad king and we're a bad people.
Well, I want to move on to Florida, and Veronica, that's why we wanted to get you involved in this conversation, because Florida is a bit of a hot spot now. Coronavirus cases continue to surge this week. Deaths and hospitalizations, I'm reading, hitting record levels. Give us a little bit of the sort of latest from Florida. What's going on down there?
Sure. Well, it's not looking good, particularly in hospitals in Miami-Dade County that are reporting staff being really stretched thin. So, for instance, Jackson Memorial Hospital, it's our largest public health system in the state, has requested from the state 100 nurses to come help out. Another large hospital system is contracting as well with nurses. And patients, hospitalization rates are going up, and so is the percentage of tests coming back positive. So it's not looking good.
Now, let me ask you about the response from your governor, DeSantis. He's been saying that the rising cases are principally among young people. And he said, quote, "and you can't control young people," unquote. But your reporting suggests that there are concerns about the safety of Florida's considerable elderly population as well. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I became really concerned with that when I started hearing the governor talk about these so-called isolation centers where individuals who live in nursing homes or assisted living facilities who have COVID-19 and they go into a hospital for treatment, once they are discharged, not because they've tested negative, but because they no longer need that critical care, then the governor has been announcing pretty regularly that they go to these other nursing homes that have been chosen as the isolation centers. And these nursing homes already have had COVID-19 cases. The problem that I'm finding is that these nursing homes, many have very alarming records. I mean, some of them, one in particular, has been fined more than $70,000 by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. They have a lot of violations, double-digit patients and staff members infected with the virus. So I'm very concerned about people who still haven't recovered going to other places where they don't have this disease under control.
And Veronica, I want to ask you as well about concerns around school openings. President Trump, of course, demanded this week that states reopen schools. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis seems to be okay with that. Here he is speaking yesterday about the need to open schools in Florida.
We spent months saying that there were certain things that were essential, and that included fast food restaurants. It included Walmart. It included Home Depot. If fast food and Walmart and Home Depot, and look, I do all that, so I'm not looking down on it. But if all that is essential, then educating our kids is absolutely essential.
So, Veronica, how what's been the response to that? Is the state ready to reopen schools? What's the pushback?
No, I would say certainly there are districts who are saying that they are not ready because this is only 7 weeks away before the August opening date for schools. But I do need to say that districts do have the ability to decide whether students would be returning to the brick and mortar building or whether there would be more of this online distant learning. So there is a possibility for districts to make their own decisions. But union teachers who are members of unions are speaking up about there just being very little guidance so soon before the schools have to open.
Right. Well, here's President Trump, who's from this week, doubling down on his insistence that schools reopen. He was speaking yesterday in the White House Rose Garden.
We have to get our schools open and stop this political nonsense. And it's only political nonsense. It's politics. They don't want to open because they think it will help them on November 3rd.
So there's the president talking about pushback to opening schools as political nonsense. Betsy, what are you taking away from this debate and back and forth about school openings?
The president sees the question of how to continue efforts to contain and mitigate the coronavirus as first and foremost a political question rather than as a public health question. And his accusations that sort of unspecified people want to keep the schools closed to damage him politically is very much of a piece with his thinking about any group of people or any institution that he believes holds positions which could harm him politically. When people disagree with him, he often accuses them of conspiring to try to undermine him or conspiring to push a hoax. In this case, what we do know is that on the first, keeping schools closed is absolutely going to be a challenge to families of school-aged children. There's no question about that. Second, we know that reopening schools in a responsible way is going to have a major impact on the next chapter of this pandemic situation that's played out in the United States. It's a complicated process. It's a challenging process. School districts are going to take different approaches. State governments may take different approaches depending on the level of concern and danger in these jurisdictions. But it's not a process that's being made by these leaders because they're trying to somehow sabotage President Trump's reelection campaign, regardless of what you may or may not hear from the president's Twitter feed.
Right. Lots more to talk about. Betsy, Jack, stand by. And Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter for WLRN in Miami. That's the NPR station in Miami. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. We're going to take a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar, Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about another packed week in the news. I'm here with Politico's Betsy Woodruff Swan and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Also joining us from Detroit, Michigan, Kat Stafford. She's a race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Kat, great to have you back on Point. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me again.
So I want to talk about presidential election politics this week, beginning with former Vice President Joe Biden, who offered his first detailed economic proposal yesterday at a Pennsylvania factory. So let's listen to a bit of that. Here he is speaking yesterday in Pennsylvania.
We have an economic crisis that's left almost 18 million Americans out of work, with some of the greatest pain inflicted on small businesses and communities of color. A national reckoning on the issue of racial injustice is also that's long plagued the United States of America, long plagued our country, has come on top of a widening economic inequity and a mounting climate crisis.
So that's Joe Biden, the former vice president and presidential candidate, speaking yesterday in Pennsylvania. He offered a bit of a populist vision to build back better. It included a pitch to buy American, among other things, big investments in American-made goods and technology, clean energy and other sectors. Jack Beatty, I'm wondering what you heard in the Biden in Biden's economic message yesterday.
Well, he's sort of dishing the president, isn't he? This is the president's ground, buy America, America first. And according to the reporting, the White House just hasn't been able to get together on its own buy America, buy American plan. And so Biden is first out the gate with it, making it tellingly in Pennsylvania, where many of those goods would be obtained. So he's essentially scooped the president on one of the president's main rhetorical platforms. And, you know, he's got other things going for him. The public says the salient issues are handling the pandemic. He's ahead by double digits there. Biden is over Trump. And secondarily, the public says handling race relations. Again, Biden up double digits over Trump. And even on the issue of law and order, which is Trump's new ground from Mount Rushmore and so on, Biden is up on handling law and order by 7. So the new the president's pitch isn't working on law and order thus far. His effort to change the subject isn't working. And on the subjects the public cares about, race and the pandemic, the president is way behind.
Hmm. Kat Stafford, what did you make of that speech? I mean, Jack talked about sort of taking a page from Trump's playbook in terms of buy American and so forth. In the past, Democrats have embraced open trade, globalism. This does seem to be a bit of a pivot here. What did you make of what Biden was talking about?
Well, I think first we need to recognize that in this moment, we are facing three crises, really. You know, the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, which is still ravaging the nation, and really also these protests, this growing movement that we have seen globally, really, to deal with systemic racism, to deal with a lot of these systemic inequities that have long plagued the United States of America, right? So when I heard the VP's Vice President Joe Biden's speech, what I really heard was someone who was, in a sense, trying to speak to Americans who are dealing with this, who are in the throes of so much uncertainty right now. The AP, we just launched a series just like this week about America Disrupted, and kind of really looking at the different facets of what is America and what does America want to be in its future. So when we talk about Biden's speech, I heard him really speaking to various demographics of this nation right now who are looking for someone to really address what they're dealing with. There are so many folks who are out of work right now, who are dealing with the loss of loved ones, who themselves are fighting this illness. And so I think Biden was really trying to speak to his base, but also to gain some new support for folks who may have voted for Trump, who were enraptured by his promise of a renaissance in manufacturing that they have yet to see.
Right. Betsy, what about you? Did Biden speak to the moment in a way that was effective yesterday? What did you hear?
I think it'll take a bit of time to figure out the impact of this speech. But one reason that it's particularly important is that it's an example of Vice President Biden really going on offense, not just criticizing Trump's decisions or discussing his concerns about the way that the president is handling the multiple crises that Kat just detailed. But in addition to that, laying out his own vision of what the economy might look like, how the United States might function under his presidency, essentially saying not just going after Trump, but working to more clearly define himself and define the work that he's doing. And this is something that's going to deeply concern the Trump administration and Trump's campaign as well. Part of the reason for that is that their own internal polls are pretty much matching the public polls that we're seeing when it comes to the president lagging substantially behind Biden, particularly in key must-win swing states, including Pennsylvania and Michigan. When Biden sort of goes on offense with a message that's tailored toward reaching the blue-collar voters who helped Trump win in 2016, that's something that won't sit well with Trump's campaign team, to put it delicately.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, he's doing much better. Biden is polling, if the polling is correct, in terms of those key swing states as well that were so important for Donald Trump in 2016. So the vice president's speech followed a major address by President Trump last Friday at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. And the president offered a bit of a preview of his reelection campaign. So here he is talking about what he called the new far left fascism pervading the nation.
This left wing cultural revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. In so doing, they would destroy the very civilization that rescued billions from poverty, disease, violence, and hunger, and that lifted humanity to new heights of achievement, discovery, and progress. To make this possible, they are determined to tear down every statue, symbol, and memory of our national heritage.
That's President Trump speaking last Friday at Mount Rushmore. Kat Stafford, you did some really interesting reporting on this speech. What did you take away?
The first takeaway is that the president is quite naturally speaking to his current base. This is the rhetoric that we know his base, it appeals to them. But in this moment where we have so many people in the streets protesting, asking for America to recognize again the oppression and systemic racism that has been rooted in this country that has impacted Black Americans, quite frankly, for what, 400 plus years, that speech is just not going to do anything to quell this swell of support that we're seeing to dismantle the criminal justice system, to deal with health inequities and economic inequities. So I think when the president makes these speeches, it's only going to further the protests. It's only going to make these young folks really want to make sure that their voices are heard. And I think that is what we're definitely seeing on the ground right now.
Jack, you know, we often describe President Trump's speeches when he's out on the hustings. He does a good job in terms of appealing to what we call his base. Was there any evidence to you in that speech that there was an effort there to expand that base?
Not at all. He just doubles down every time. And I think his staff was pleased that in the speech on Saturday and then the one in the White House grounds on Sunday, he kept his tongue off the Confederacy. You know, the statues were of Washington and Jefferson, and he even on the White House talked about we're going to have a national sort of field of statues, and he said Sojourner Truth will be there and Martin Luther King. So far, so good. But on Monday, what does he do? A tweet
you know, got to have those Confederate statues. He couldn't keep away from it. Yeah, and, you know, people that want the Confederate statues, that is not a very big demographic. And such as it is, he's already long since pocketed it.
Yeah, interesting. Betsy, to you, you know, there's been a lot of writing about that speech in South Dakota, and a lot of folks have sort of suggested that it was a kind of racialized appeal to a kind of aggrieved sort of white audience. But conservatives have pushed back on that interpretation. I was reading Mark Thiessen in The Washington Post that sort of defended the speech and pointed out that Trump said, "We embrace tolerance, not prejudice," that he praised a list of great black Americans. He cited Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. And in general, Thiessen accused much of the media for mischaracterizing the Mount Rushmore speech. Fair in your view? What do you think?
The Mount Rushmore speech is important because it let Trump, by design, position himself as opposed to the protest movement that we've seen unfolding in this country. And while Mark Thiessen is correct that Trump name-checked, you know, many non-incendiary components of the way that the United States government worked, the big issue with this speech and the reason it was so important to the president himself and that he wanted to deliver it in this really important place in the United States in front of Mount Rushmore is that it was defining the way his campaign is going to go moving forward. He's going to be presenting himself as the opposite of the protesters, as opposed to the protesters. He's going to be following his gut. He's going to be following his instincts, jettisoning advice from people like his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who've encouraged him to try to support a moderate incremental criminal justice and policing reform. We shouldn't expect anything from the president that would suggest that he'll be trying to build bridges to the protesters, to recognize the validity of the concerns that they're reading that they're highlighting, and to try to build unity in this country. Instead, the way that the president was posturing and positioning himself with that speech was as a president who's going to run for re-election by trying to excite his base and by doing everything in his power to demonize the people who've criticized not just him, but also have raised concerns about broader issues, broader inequities in this country that are much bigger than the president.
I want to move on and talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and about the protests for racial justice, which continue across the country. Kat, this is a movement that seems to have a lot of momentum and continues to move. What are you seeing out there?
Yes. Yeah, so just this week, I had a story published about the Black Lives Movement for Black Lives that announced efforts to push actual legislation to deal with a lot of the issues that they're talking about. And when we talk about Black Lives Matter, I want to be clear that what they're asking for is not just related to criminal justice. They're talking again about every facet of America that they feel in their eyes has impacted Black people. When you look at COVID-19 and how Black Americans have been disproportionately impacted, there are a lot of reasons for that. So this legislation that they're trying to push is really historic in a sense, because I can't remember in a time where we have seen Black Lives Matter movement take their effort and push for actual change. So we'll see what comes of that. But I think that this moment that we're in is really speaking to a lot of what people are feeling. And, you know, we had a story where we talked to this Republican in Saginaw, and he said, "Never before has America been this divided." But my counter to that is America has always been divided. It's just that most people are now waking up to the injustices that many people of color have been dealing with for quite some time.
I want to ask you more about this Black Lives Matter proposed legislation. It's called the Breathe Act, a reference to the killing of George Floyd, who said, "I can't breathe," before he died with a police officer's knee on the back of his neck. So what's in it? What is the sort of legislative scope of the Breathe Act?
Yes. So one of the things that they're really pushing for, and again, this is a culmination of more than 150 organizations that came together on this, and they're pushing for some really radical and sweeping changes They want to get rid of the DEA. They want to scale back the funding for the Department of Defense. They want to reimagine what policing really looks like in America and put, in their eyes, the community first and create some robust programming that will focus more on community building as opposed to so much policing, which they believe has contributed to a lot of the issues that they are seeing in their community. So again, this is really sweeping legislative changes. And of course, it's going to face a lot of pushback if it actually gets introduced. But one woman I spoke with made an interesting point. She said, you know, once upon a time, people thought that the Civil Rights Act was radical. People thought that women having the right to vote was radical. People having the right to vote was radical at one point in this country. So when we're talking about changing the criminal justice system and all of these other facets of America, is it really radical? And that was the question that she posed to me. So I think we're going to see the movement for Black Lives continue to push for a lot of sweeping changes across the board and not just within the criminal justice system.
Hmm. Well, it's a profound question. Betsy Woodruff Swan, what do you think in terms of the significance of the BREATHE Act, of Black Lives Matter pushing a kind of legislative program here? Can it go anywhere? What's the effect in your view?
It's really notable because it presents such a sharp contrast to what President Trump is advocating for. Last night, he did an interview on Fox News with Sean Hannity, and they specifically talked about one of the issues that this legislation addresses, the issue of taking surplus military equipment from the Pentagon and distributing it throughout the country to small police departments. The impact of militarization of police is something that's concerned activists for years and years and years, long predating the Trump administration. And the program that distributed this militarized equipment to police is something that's gone on under Republicans, both of the Republican and under presidents, excuse me, both of the Republican and Democratic Party. But in his interview last night, Trump expressed full-throated enthusiasm for this work. He said that the prior administration, President Obama and Vice President Biden, weren't excited and enthusiastic about distributing this equipment, even though the Pentagon, under their leadership, did distribute the equipment as well. Trump said police all over the country are thanking him profusely for sending them this equipment. Meanwhile, the fact that police in the United States are in some ways hard to distinguish from military troops, U.S. troops, fighting in war zones is something that's contributed in a meaningful way to undermining community trust and confidence in law enforcement. When you have law enforcement rolling around in Humvees and using tactical weapons on protesters, that's not the kind of thing that sends a signal that law enforcement, that police departments are trying to build communicative, positive, and a warm relationships with the people who they're supposed to be protecting. The fact that Trump is now essentially campaigning on his support for militarization of police is an immense and important contrast to the work that the Movement for Black Lives is doing with this legislation.
We are talking about the week in the news. Lots more to talk about, including the Supreme Court decision, two of them, on Trump's tax returns, on the president's tax returns. We're going to get into that when we come back. We're going to say goodbye to Kat Stafford, race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Kat, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciated it.
Thanks for having me.
Betsy, Jack, stand by. We're talking about the week in the news. We're going to take a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
The This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. On Monday, we're bringing back finance experts Michelle Singletary and Rana Farouhar to answer your questions. How have you changed your spending habits during the pandemic? What do you want to know about whether to keep your money in the markets? How to keep your savings safe? Tell us your story. Leave a message for us at 617-353-0683. Again, those are questions and your story about finances during the pandemic, 617-353-0683. That's for Monday's program. Today, we're talking about the week in the news. I'm here with Politico's Betsy Woodruff-Swan and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And Jack, I didn't get a chance to come to you at the end of that last break, and I think it's an important issue. I want to ask you your thoughts about this proposed legislation, the BREATHE Act from Black Lives Matter. Among other things, the act would divest federal dollars from prisons and police. What's the significance to you of the fact that there's now a real legislative agenda being proposed here?
There is, but on the much milder House, version that was passed, led by the Congressional Black Caucus, the Senate went nowhere with it. And it may be that nothing is going to be done. They say maybe they can go back to it in September. But with all this outcry, there will be no, it appears there's going to be no legislation, even of a mild sort, this year. But you know, all this talk about the police, this comes at a moment when violence has just erupted in America's city. 65 people shot in New York over the 4th of July, 87 in Chicago, including a 7-year-old girl killed in Atlanta, an 8-year-old shot dead. Mm. The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, says it's got to stop. The reality is this. These aren't police officers shooting people in the streets of Atlanta. These are members of the community shooting each other. That is a terrible backdrop of this moment, and it underlines Black Lives Matter, especially the lives of children snuffed out in this gun violence.
Hmm. I want to move on and talk about two big decisions from the Supreme Court regarding President Trump's tax returns. Two rulings clear the way for prosecutors in New York to seek the president's financial records. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday following the decision granting New York State prosecutors access to those tax records. She said that the decision allows for Congress to eventually receive the details of the president's finances.
And I don't know what they're even saying about it. I hear he's tweeting one thing and then the other people are saying another. But whatever it is, it's not good news for the president of the United States.
Betsy, is that your take? Was this an outright defeat for the president of the United States? Because sort of my reading of this is, yes, New York prosecutors can get access to his tax records, but that may not happen before the election, right?
Frankly, the president and his White House team and his campaign reelection team are going to largely see this Supreme Court ruling as good news, not because of any legal principles or because of what it says about executive power or the separation of powers, but simply because it means that Congress is extremely unlikely to get the president's financial information before this election. Mm. From a purely political perspective, which is the way that the president and his team view these complex and far-reaching legal issues, this is good news for President Trump. If his financial information had gone to Congress, members of Congress almost certainly would have made at least some of it public to the American people. It's been years and years that people have been trying to get a sense of what's in the president's tax returns, and the Supreme Court did nothing to make it possible or to increase the likelihood that that information is going to be available before Election Day. Now, the fact that this prosecutor in Manhattan will be able to potentially have access to the president's financial records, obviously the president's not going to be excited about that. But if his access to those records is part of a grand jury proceeding, then they'll be secret. They won't immediately become public, and they might not become public anytime remotely soon. The reality is that the political peril that the president was in prior to this Supreme Court ruling is significantly smaller for him now than it had been.
Hmm. Jack Beattie, is that your view? Because on the one hand, you can read the decision, and it's part of it anyway, is kind of a rebuke to the president, the idea that nobody's above the law. On the other hand, as Betsy says, the political effect of this helps the president.
It sure does. Now, someone pointed out, a congressman, you know, you can't outrun the law, but he's outrunning the clock for November. And sure, this is a political win for him, even if the Roberts opinion is stinging. A king, he writes, is born to power and can do no wrong. The president, by contrast, is of the people and subject to law. That is a reputation of this president's claim of, quote, absolute immunity.
Mm. I want to ask you about another decision yesterday, this regarding Native Americans who applauded this. Lots of emotion from Indian country around this. So the court ruled that about half of the land in Oklahoma is within a Native American reservation, a decision that will have huge consequences for both past and future criminal civil cases. Betsy, this, you know, listening to the coverage of this yesterday, there was just an amazing sort of emotional response by members of the Native American community. Tell us a little bit about your takeaway from this decision.
This decision is important because, without question, it's a substantial and historic win for the Native American community in Oklahoma. One book that I think people who are interested in this issue might really enjoy is called Killers of the Flower Moon, a deeply reported story about the incredible mistreatment of Native communities in Oklahoma, the rise of the FBI, and the way that federal and state and local law enforcement really failed the Native American communities in that state. That said, one of the arguments that critics of this decision have made, including Justice Roberts, is that it's going to make things more complicated in Oklahoma for law enforcement. Essentially, the criticism is that particular criticism is a practical one rather than a legal one. And Chief Justice Roberts tends to almost always side and rule in favor of what law enforcement wants on issues like this. But of course, his side did not see the day. Rather, these Native American communities emerged successful, arguing not necessarily that the practical implications of the mechanics of law enforcement should predominate, but rather that this principled issue of how Native sovereignty over Native land works should have been the foremost consideration. So this is a historical moment for those communities, without question.
Mm. I want to move on before we run out of time, because there's a lot more to talk about, including Russia denying allegations this week that it paid militants to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Russians called this nonsense. It was first reported in the New York Times, and the Russian Foreign Ministry said the initial story in the Times demonstrated, quote, low intellectual abilities of U.S. intelligence propagandists, end quote. Jack, what do we need to know about this story?
Well, we need to know that against fierce competition, indeed historically unprecedented competition, this could well be the worst scandal of the Trump administration. It has been 2 weeks since this was revealed, since the Times reported that several American deaths, including a car bomb that killed three Marines in 2019, that Russia made large payments to the Taliban after those attacks. So there it is. The Times is on record saying that. They have sources. The CIA apparently has been pushing that. And the president, what has the president done? He's said we have to find the leakers of that. Has he said one word to Putin? Has he threatened to pull out our ambassador? Has he done anything? What happened here was an act of war committed by Russia against United States interests, against our troops and our president. Rather than defending them and demanding answers from Putin, what is he doing? He's inviting Putin back into the G7. He speaks to him again and again on the phone. And according to Carl Bernstein, Bernstein's reporting, he fawns on Putin on the phone. And this gets back to the Supreme Court decision. What is in his tax returns? Is the Trump Organization, as Adam Davidson
I think, cogently suggests, if not proves, is it effectively a money laundering business? Is that its business model? And has Russian oligarch money been sustaining Trump? And is that what he's why he seems to be so in hock to Putin?
So I'm looking at a tweet from the president, June 28th. Nobody briefed me. Nobody told Vice President Pence or Chief of Staff Mark Meadows about the so-called attacks on our troops in Afghanistan by Russians, as reported through, quote, an anonymous source, unquote, by the fake news New York Times. Everybody is denying it, and there have not been many attacks on us. Betsy, Jack called this one of the biggest scandals of the Trump administration, for which there's lots of competition. What's your view of where this story stands?
Well, it's certainly just absolutely factually inaccurate for the president to say that everybody is denying this. Multiple media outlets, including Politico, have confirmed the New York Times reporting that Russia's military intelligence service offered to pay money, to pay currency to fighters in Afghanistan who killed members of the coalition forces fighting there, including U.S. troops. This is obviously a story that I think horrifies everyone who's familiar with it. Nobody wants to see American troops having dollar figures floating above their heads. One piece of this that's interesting when we're talking about the intelligence briefings, the president obviously has complained that he wasn't told about this. One thing that's interesting is that many of the president's intelligence briefers have privately expressed concerns and hesitations about even talking about Russia verbally when they brief him. I talked about this in detail with a former White House official who was privy to the way that these briefings were structured, who said that throughout the first year of the president's administration, these briefers realized that when they brought up topics related to Russia, particularly topics that didn't reflect particularly flatteringly on the Russian government, that the president would respond in such an angry and exercised way that it risked taking the entire briefing off the rails. So the material related to Russia stayed in the written part of his briefings. Of course, there's a written document part of these briefings, and there's also a verbal conversation that happens with it. It's two parts. But those briefers felt that if they were going to effectively give the president the information that he needed, it was extremely difficult for them to do their jobs properly if they raised material related to Russia's malign behavior to President Trump. In other words, the president himself basically disincentivized his top intelligence officials from giving him clear and fulsome information regarding the threat that Russia has posed to the United States and its allies.
Well, indeed, you said it's a story that horrifies everyone, and I think that is true. With the clock running down, I want to move on to at least one more story here, the lingering effects of the Russia investigation, the impeachment trial against President Donald Trump. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a key witness in the impeachment trial of the president, will retire after 21 years in the military. His lawyer, David Pressman, said in a statement that Vindman is leaving the Army, quote, after it has been made clear that his future within the institution he has dutifully served will forever be limited, unquote. Jack, tell us about this. What do we know about why Vindman is retiring?
Well, his attorney says that he was effectively pushed out, certainly pushed out of the White House and given a job that he, sort of a make-work job. And he was on a list to be promoted to full colonel. He's a lieutenant colonel. And the White House was pressuring the Pentagon not to promote him. And Tammy Duckworth, the senator from Illinois, to her credit, was going to hold up the entire defense bill to protect Vindman. In other words, she was going to say, if you don't give this man a promotion, which he deserves, Purple Heart winner and so on, you're not going to get your defense bill. But he quit before that happened. And, you know, to contrast him, Purple Heart winner, man who did his duty, answered a subpoena, spoke to Congress, told the truth. He told his father, he reassured his father at the time, here, meaning the United States, right prevails. It didn't in his case, but he's an example of an exemplary, it seems to me, American moral hero standing up and telling the truth no matter the consequences.
You know, Jack, you mentioned Tammy Duckworth, and I wanted to ask you about her. This is another story. She, of course, is the Democratic senator from Illinois, and she's been talked about as a possible running mate for Joe Biden. And she penned a powerful opinion piece this week in the New York Times responding to attacks on her by Tucker Carlson of Fox News. Carlson attacked her for calling for a national dialogue about the removing statues of George Washington. Among other things, Carlson said people like her, quote, actually hate America. Well, Duckworth is a veteran. She lost both of her legs fighting in Iraq. She said she would do it again to defend Carlson's right to say what he believes, but blasted him for daring to question her patriotism. But she said she's used to veiled racist taunts. And she added this line, which I love, "These titanium legs don't buckle." It was quite a piece, Jack. What did you read in that speaks to this moment?
Well, yeah, she also quoted Washington himself warning against Americans, quote, to guard against the impostures of pretended patriotism. Well, there it is. Tucker Carlson's pretended imposture of patriotism. You know, it reminds me of Dr. Johnson's patriotism as the last refuge of a scoundrel. And in the scoundrel here is not Tammy Duckworth. And imagine the gall of someone like a Fox TV host who hasn't served, daring to question the patriotism of a woman who lost both her legs in service. I mean, it's a new low, and it shows that there's no the danger really of the Fox world, that you can say almost anything and you're rewarded for this verbal extremity and these sorts of absurd attacks. But good for her.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Couldn't make this show without their talents and dedication. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.